to move from a behavioral approach to doing good is just not enough. We have to step up to an evolved capacity paradigm beyond a maze based on the manager's ideals. And to do that, it cannot be a maze or model developed by managers or experts. Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're super happy and excited to thank our sponsor, Guayaki. They brew an enlivening beverage from a naturally caffeinated and nourishing leaf of a species of holly that you may know as mate. It contains 24 vitamins and minerals, 15 amino acids, and abundant polyphenols. Even the Pasteur Institute and the Paris Scientific Society concluded in 1964 that it's difficult to find a plant in any area of the world equal to mate in nutritional value, and that yerba mate contains practically all the vitamins necessary to sustain life. On top of that, they support community and ecosystem regeneration, bringing together art, music, and celebrations in many locations. Stay up to date on their events at guayaki.com. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. Ones that you may not know you to be asking, we think you should. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swartout. And with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
Okay, so everybody, I suggested the topic this week because it seems like something that's getting talked about a lot on big podcasts, and I'm actually not convinced everyone is nailing the topic on the head. So today is all about something we collectively need to get our acts together on, which is bias. Last week, I found myself reading an article in Harvard Business Review on the subject and was honestly drawn in by its logic and ideas. But, and this is a big but, as we always find with a bit of deeper examination, there's more than meets the eye.
Yeah, I agreed with you when you shared it with me. It is working on a subject, diversity and inclusion is their take on it, or one slice on that. And it's in the news regularly. And yet, the suggestions they make seem to fall into the category of what I'd call better than the bad stuff. It is not really what will make the deep difference. And I really welcome the opportunity to have this conversation with you, Zach.
Yeah, for sure. So this article, so everyone can follow along if they'd like, is titled How the Best Bosses Interrupt Bias on Their Teams. It's in the Harvard Business Review November-December issue from 2019 by Joan Williams and Sky Mihailo. Also, just so you know, they actually did a podcast on Harvard IdeaCast, also entitled A New Way to Combat Bias at Work.
So what drew you in and made you want to examine it deeper?
Yeah, so I had a hard time pinning down exactly how I, as a manager, might manage biases in myself. Instead, it felt like I was being armed with tools to make other people fight some kind of abstract bias war for me. And also, the ultimate goal of all these approaches seemed to be better performance and broader kind of creativity and ideas. I think for my business, those seem more like means rather than ends. Carol, what did you think?
Well, my reflection on first reading it was that the ideas offered would certainly disrupt biased business actions that have become very pervasive in life. And that's good. But it doesn't disrupt the thinking that leads to them and is more pervasive than just in diversity and inclusion programs. Once I applied our living systems frameworks to it, increasing what I could see and you obviously could see too, it left way too much on the table and it missed the path that serves not only the underlying causes here, but it also missed the broader opportunity to be more effective.
Yeah. So on my second and third reading, actually, I could see this was based on a behavioral paradigm, which is something that we talked about before. So meaning it's all set up to modify the behavior of people without direct permission or even engagement. This HBR article seeks to help create outcomes for diversity and inclusion, but it externalizes impacts in business and society. In other words, it leaves negative impacts for others to handle and pick up the slack on. It stops short because they don't work on consciousness and capability to be more discerning, but only on norms and acceptable behavior.
Just to make it clear for our listeners, the change in behavior can do much that they're suggesting. And so we're not feeling like it's horrible in every possible way. It just has a few side effects and some other things we want to pick up. It's a little like using a 20th century technology, that is behavior modification, on a 21st century device, that is like the current organization in human minds. And therefore, it is producing some incremental improvement when radical steps are really needed, given what we can see in society, our political system, and our social justice system.
And we've referred to that approach in the past, actually, as something called satisficing, where you settle for something that's better than the bad, basically, without using the thinking that works more essentially to make a real difference.
Yeah, where did you see that in this piece?
So they said explicitly that you don't need to work on how people think, but just change the behavior by management actions and requirements. This reminds me of Sam Harris's podcast, actually. He has a podcast that I'm sure everybody knows called Waking Up, where he interviewed Daniel Kahneman in front of a live studio audience, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow and won a Nobel Prize for his work on cognitive biases. In this podcast, Sam asked him what he's learned about himself by using his own bias research on his thinking. So he said he hasn't and doesn't because he believes it's hopeless and we're all subject to biases, so why try? This is the definition of a fixed mindset, as some of you will know from what we've discussed in other podcasts in the past. Instead of seeing potential for thinking capabilities to be built, it's a problem to be solved out there. This doesn't really change society more comprehensively, but instead works on what we can see and manage. But the workers still leave work and vote and sit on juries and engage in a social context where their biases still exist.
Yeah, Kahneman's answer is really depressing, isn't it? Plus, the benefits of working on the mental shift needed with workers, just like you talk about for when they leave work, is about consciousness of their bias, which will benefit the entire business in other ways and arenas. This approach offered by these authors is really one of what I'm calling a bucket approach to change. That is, this is our bucket to work on, like diversity and inclusion, and we're only going to pay attention to what is in our bucket. The problem, however, is not limited to what's in their bucket. The foundational challenge limits human progress, which is the bias in the mind. It limits progress in individuals, businesses, and it's very pervasive. So this ability to manage our inner processing and the cognitive biases that control it is a bit urgent.
Yeah, the approach of behavioralists is often narrow, since it requires a direct action for a specific path to a specified goal. With a more complete approach, we can do more by developing people in a more comprehensive way. However, what the behavioralists are doing and what's reflected in the article is about having managers managing their targeted audience to define the maze that's allowed for their workers. For example, they said that the manager needs to require more candidates as a percentage of gender and race, which will give you a better likelihood of hiring women and people of color, which is a good outcome, at least for sure.
You're right, but that's still external, which is the behavioralist. So that is true what you're saying. But why just define the maze that you're going to run people through, the maze being the behaviors you have to follow? Why not give people the capability to see the maze they are in and how to become re-engineered, so to speak, of mazes in their own mind? Then they can see it in how they do not only diversity questions, but ecological choices and product design. The biases are actually pervasive, and this is only one place they're showing up.
Yeah, so the authors justify this by saying that, quote, the bias is, quote, devilishly difficult to eliminate, unquote. So you don't have to deal with that, they argue. Instead, you can interrupt it. It's seen as a behavior problem, not a capability problem, for people to see their own mental bias-making machine at work. I think capability building in this arena would make us better humans in all walks of life. We need to learn to manage the process in ourselves, by ourselves, and not by being managed by others who are trying to get us to perform in a prescribed way. Basically, it's taking the behavioral paradigm into a do-good paradigm by trying to modify behavior towards doing the right thing. But if we don't shift the mental capacity of each human to see themselves and not be managed for their own good, we're still just rats in a maze. But for good causes, of course. Carol, now that I'm saying all that, this is actually, I'm starting to get a little bit depressed. So what do we do here?
Well, obviously, we need to move on to the regenerative, that evolved capacity paradigm, which sees this as a capability challenge, not a functional behavioral one, and work on that capacity being evolved. So we need to also shift there from the outside source, being the manager managing us, in this case, management who's requiring a particular maze be designed and followed. We want to instead design a schooling or a school process for the mind of all the people who are there, not mind management of them, but our own ability to see it. Now, this is not an abstract idea or too much work or something that's overwhelmingly difficult, as they suggest. It's only difficult because we don't see it as a capacity or capability challenge. We see it behaviorally. And when you do it behaviorally, you think you've got to have the right incentive or reward, which for them is elusive. So they give up like Kahneman did.
Right. So instead, let's show what a regenerative paradigm that's really about evolving capacity looks like and how it works.
Okay, well, let me suggest something to get us started here. It is educating everyone on how they work every day on every subject, that is, with their biases running, and adding capability building exercises into every task they're doing while they're doing it. It improves, therefore, each and every business practice, including financial effectiveness, because we build bias into that one also. They are different, but in many cases, they're exactly the same. Now, this is not overnight, but it takes about a year to get people familiar with and to embed this idea of watching their own mind at work while they're doing work. And by then, the end of that year, it's starting to spill over into how we engage our families, our social endeavors and discourse. I think that's a good place to get started. What would you add to that, Zach?
Yeah, so I think we introduce reflection into any activities and events, drawing on frameworks that serve to help each person examine what's going on in our mind in relation to a super concrete subject.
Yeah, and one of the examples of that kind of framework you're talking about, these living systems frameworks, is a framework we call modes of behavior, mental behavior. So we learn to be able to see ourselves and be able to examine ourselves. We use it on ourselves, never on anyone else. So you can't interpret whether people are reactive, ego, purposeful, wherever they are. They can only determine that from inside. This is all based on a premise, this exercise and way of working, that we all tend to be on automatic and react from stuck patterns that probably have not served us well for years, but we can't see them. Racial and gender bias is just one place where we have an example of being biased. We're a huge bundle of biases from our deeply ingrained patterns of thought, and they're all unexamined.
In other words, the authors are missing the point that we're biased towards some thoughts and patterns of thoughts on almost every subject and every work practice. They're unlikely to have ever been examined for their accuracy, which is much less whether they produce what we actually want at the end of the day. Instead, we argue with others over how important they are and do what's called steel manning our own biases with logic, at least in our own head. So how do we stop that, Carol?
Well, we begin to question them. For example, using another framework that we've talked about before called three lines of work. So image three concentric rings, the second one and the third one each larger than the inner ring, where we're looking at actions going out three rings. Remember when you used to skip a stone on a pond and it would create ripples? It's metaphorically like that, although not exactly physical. So if you think about actions like words, decisions, deeds, and you get people used to asking, what is or what is likely to be the result from that perspective I'm holding in taking that action? What could it produce in results? And not just for myself, but on everybody who might get touched by it. Then image the next ring from this action we're taking. What is the likely outcome of that on other people? So we get this results. Some things get produced, but it can have an outcome for other people who are probably are not there. That's where externalities come from. And finally, if we go out to the third ring, you can start to say, well, long term, there's likely to be effect of that on my family, our families, our society, our democracy. And as far as we can think out at the moment, we can begin to move from our actions into results, outcomes, and effects. And if we could get used to organizing ourselves in that kind of impact consideration, maybe it could become a habit in an organization and it would build a mind that could see more.
I remember, funnily enough, the first time you had us do an examination of an article like we're doing today with this kind of rigorous questioning, and I was startled by what I saw. I was able to see incompleteness both in my own thinking, but also in relation to the ideas that I was reading. I assumed that I knew what I was talking about, and so did the author. And, you know, it turns out not so much.
Yeah, that's why we do that exercise over and over again, right? Most people are surprised, just like you, especially well-intentioned people. People have a good heart. Many who run or they work in mission-driven, purpose-driven companies, and they're surprised at their own good intentions and the resulting actions, which have been unexamined up until now, are not producing the effects they intended on society and democracy or even the business they run or work in. They're working on big questions like climate change, but are limited by their own unexamined assumptions, and we should say biases, therefore, here, following in the footsteps of what they adopted a long time ago, usually from others, which was also unexamined by them.
That seems to be one of the biggest reasons for learning to utilize living systems frameworks is really about developing thinking on a subject of work. It's also about working on my thinking as I'm working on an idea, for sure. So this leads often to new perspectives and approaches I wouldn't have considered by automatically adopting or dismissing an idea.
Yeah, and if we use them well, the frameworks, if we use them well, they support us in really disrupting bias at its source, that is, our own thinking process. And the examiner is the individual on themselves who is able to pick apart what they're doing, not have other people try and tell them. So in that way, we become in charge of seeing the bias, which limits us in what we can see and how we're interpreting things. This way makes the shift in our thinking move much faster and deeper, and it's amazingly simple to institute. So you got my opinion, Zach. What's your experience with examining biases or automatic thinking? How you go about doing that?
Great question. Okay. So we have one framework that's actually in your new book, The Regenerative Life, that lets us look at inner obstacles, which lets me find my own biases. And this one can be pretty painful, everybody. Essentially, it helps me to look at energy drains or where my thinking has me leaking energy like a boat with holes in it. The one I fall into quite often is subjectivism. This is the process where I lose connection to the relativism that rationally exists in the universe. This is causing me to believe that I, or humans in general, are central to existence. One way I approach this is by asking, what is the whole I'm trying to work on or contribute to in this moment? I immediately become aware of much larger systems at work here beyond just myself and human-made systems.
Yeah, I have a similar experience when I think about me pulling together those energy drains or kind of inner obstacles we have. The one that gets me, although I can get caught up in thinking I'm the center of the universe too, but I get caught a lot by attachments, which I think is another way of talking about bias, where I see something and I can't unsee it that way. And if I'm not looking at saying, what assumptions are built in here? What attachments? What am I sure I'm right about? And I'm not willing to question and now question that. That has an effect of being able to disrupt me disrupting myself, not be disrupted by maze someone else is running me through, where I guarantee you, I would argue and not be willing to see it.
And I should warn people also that the first time you're going to do something like this, it's going to feel like stopping for 10 minutes out of every hour to stand and stretch, right? Which is kind of like a habit that gets talked about all the time. It feels like a waste of time initially when we could be way more productive.
Yeah, but soon you realize, I even for the standing and stretching, have realized it makes me more productive because I'm eradicating wasted effort of where I'm fidgeting or whatever else is going on with my mind. I tend to wipe out the poor mental processing and replace it with more higher leverage change ideas like I do when I can see my attachments. So it's not issue-based, change one thing at a time, but it's more helping humans, me, human, become more conscious and therefore in that process be more self-developing of my own capability.
So what the authors of this article don't seem, at least from what's being presented, to understand is that they are contributing to the problem of keeping humans' thinking and biases hidden from them by using a behavioral approach. For example, some manager examines a situation, like let's say diversity in the workplace, which is tackled by this article, and comes up with a more ideal form that is to become more inclusive in hiring and promoting, which I agree is an urgent and important thing to do. But the managers then build a maze to modify the behavior and rob people of seeing their own biases and through teaching them an opportunity to teach them to examine it. People think it is faster to push people into new habits. It's not action that's needed here, but a thinking shift in capability.
Yeah, I believe that the authors here are taking the slow way. I think behavioralists think they're taking the fast way. But when you modify behavior based on a problem being defined from the outside, and then you set up a model or a maze, you then have to continuously do some kind of reinforcing, some kind of keeping people inside the maze. The fast way, not the slow way, but the fast way and the lasting way, and actually one that's more pervasive and spreads further out into their lives, is to teach people to do this for themselves. And then they learn not to just do it in this circumstance at work, but begin to see it in their whole lives. I know you and Isaac and our colleagues all see this over and over again. People see themselves when they go about this kind of reflective process and they gain the will to change. They then catch themselves over and over again. And most individuals and the leaders of business teams report, you know, the ones who are working on this say, quote, "It changed my life because it changed my capability to change myself, to see myself." And by the way, then to support others learning to do that for themselves, not me do it for them. Further, then it happened in places which I did not even see needed this bright light before. I was able to switch from this doing good on me and for others to evolving capacity to see biases, to see our mechanical thinking patterns.
So I want to take a second because I think we should talk about the benefits of engaging an organization on ongoingly and ubiquitously in a developmental practice. So first, you're getting smarter and smarter people who cannot be fooled by themselves or others. Second, they learn to see their customers and consumers more clearly without their internal and inner biases, which lead to bad design choices and sales pitches that fall flat. And third, they learn to see reconciling paths through seemingly intractable polarized situations, either with themselves or between workers or between anyone in the organization.
Yeah, and if you'd let me, I would add, I think when you're doing this kind of work, you promote an educated citizenry who can better participate in democracy because they're not being expected to follow some maze that's been set for them. This is, I think, the true meaning of corporate responsibility. This capability building and also citizenry building. And it has a more encompassing effect than it does to create a new maze that gives us some movement on inclusion. Importantly, I think we think too small. The developmental approach really changes minds, but it changes consciousness of our mental models, our mental patterns. This is reported repeatedly in businesses who take this on. And why we developed a comprehensive technology for how to do this across all domains, subjects, and persons. Only a few people who are in those processes with us for some period of time don't get it.
And if I can get more concrete here, one business result I've seen is that we can redesign work systems that have been reinforcing biased expressions beyond the three arenas the authors indicate, which is recruiting, hiring, and developing people. And more than just on human resource subjects. This can affect everything from strategy to climate change mitigation.
So, how do you feel about how we've done on examining this article you brought to us?
Well, I feel that the authors are onto some pretty important subjects here in the end. But to move from a behavioral approach to doing good is just not enough. We have to step up to an evolve capacity paradigm beyond a maze based on the manager's ideals. And to do that, it cannot be a maze or model developed by managers or experts for other people, or for that matter, a model at all. It has to be a cross-functional team leading it and using the reflective process we're speaking of here. So they are building capability to see biases that are like blinders of all kinds in all these different subjects and domains. They carry over from one to another, and we want to make it a developmental effort with living systems frameworks like we strive to do. And also engaging personal inner reflection.
Yeah, I also wish all such well-intended efforts to be less fragmented by subject. Diversity is one subject, sustainability, as though they're all separate things. And they all become embedded with biases themselves, not seeing the overlap. Because of this, you promote or need to report, because of this fragmentation, more external managers, more hierarchy, and some group of elite specialists who tells you how to manage that arena. I want this to be the scope of corporate responsibility, not by subject, but by it as an idea across the system. Because it's pretty much all the same blinders. It's not a list of things to be certified on, like fair trade or supply change or climate change. It is automatic thinking that's the problem and all the toxic practices and limited paradigms it fuels. So being a regenerative organization means doing the foundational evolve capacity work on myself, not the subject-by-subject issue efforts. It is so much faster, so much easier, so much cheaper, and has so much broader an effect in the end. Plus, it's good for the top and the bottom line of business.
Working on one bias arena at a time is actually a bias itself. So let's evolve capacity with developmental processes and regenerative approaches to how we structure it all. Actually, I think that's a good place to end.
So having a regenerative approach is why we put so much online. We have a live set of workshops where we bring together a dozen or so companies over time to develop their own capacity based on the interpretations they can make of living systems thinking processes. They come up with ways to architect their business in a more regenerative way. So check out carolsanfordinstitute.com to learn more about how businesses do this to be more pervasive. Go look under offerings and you'll see the regenerative business development community. We also have a special one just for women entrepreneurs, a separate set of work for consultants and trainers.
And don't forget to keep listening to Business Second Opinion for more ideas on working from regenerative paradigm and practices. And just so you all know, Carol's new book is out, The Regenerative Life, with an extensive workbook and book club materials, which Carol supports with live online workshops for free. Check it out and find out more at carolsanford.com.
And something else for our listeners, which is all free education. We do this through the Regenerative Business Prize. And as a result, you get a lot of extra engagement and development. And nominations are now open for the Regenerative Business Prize. You also get an opportunity to engage with our reviewers who let you bring it back again. You know, when did you get to take a test? Go home and work on it and bring it back. It's based on a rubric of the 7 first principles. So if you go to the regenerativebusinesssummit.com website, there's a tab there for the prize. And submissions are open from now till the end of March. There's a timetable there. You can download it. I think it's called Guidelines. And avoid greenwashing and really step up to regeneration.
And lastly, thanks again to our sponsors at Guayaki in your pursuit of regeneration with high integrity, and to Numi T, who sponsors the show notes. If you want one of our Get a Second Opinion mugs, send us one of your articles or topic on practices in business that you think need a second opinion. You can email us at carol@businesssecondopinion.com or find us on Twitter at @biz_second_opinion. If we use it to develop an episode, you get a mug. Also, your ratings and reviews on any platform help people find us and spread the word. Sign up for our newsletter also so you can get connections and find out more in the show notes. This has been Business Second Opinion.